All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today we are putting a button on the Falcons 2017 season. We're going to be giving our rapid reaction to their postseason press conference and wrapping up some news related to the Falcons.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalconFans.com, one of the longest running Falcon fan sites on the internet, and also the host of Locked On Falcons, your favorite Falcons podcast. So today's episode is sort of a wrap-up episode. The Falcons conducted their postseason press conference. Dan Quinn, Thomas Dimitroff were talking to the media today, giving their thoughts on the season, and you know, were peppered with many questions. A couple of things that stood out from that press conference that we're going to touch upon today. We'll jump. You know, I thought the big sort of thing that caused me, at least, you know, got my juices flowing, was when Dan Quinn sort of pointed out three things that were really the issues with the team, which were the struggles in the red zone, the turnover margin, and the lack of explosive touchdowns. Which were sort of the three things that he looked at this season, which were explain why the offensive production fell off. I can't really disagree with it. I'll take a deeper dive into that and really sort of examine whether or not, you know, his statement is true there. But let's jump right ahead and let's get into the news portion of it, where we can just sort of get our rapid takes on some of this stuff. On the coaching update, as you guys probably are well aware of, the Falcons are retaining offensive coordinator Steve Sarkisian. Of course, when we get to that latter portion with Dan Quinn's comment, I will talk a little bit in depth about Sarkisian. As I often joke on this podcast, every episode, if not every other episode, we touch upon Sark, and it's probably going to be that way in the offseason. We're going to talk quite a bit about Sark, so I'm not going to shoot my wad on the Sark takes quite yet. That stuff can be parsed out over the entire offseason. But interesting enough, the Falcons are going to undergo some coaching changes. They lost two assistants. Push Hamdan, the quarterback coach, we've known that for a couple of weeks now, that he accepted the job as the University of Washington's offensive coordinator. We just found out this week that one of the offensive assistants, Charlie Weiss Jr., yes, the son of the Charlie Weiss, will be joining Lane Kiffin as the offensive coordinator at Florida Atlantic. I think the offensive coordinator. And so, you know, those are two coaches that were new to the job this past season that the Falcons lose. So it's not as if they're losing some longtime assistants that's going to be necessarily hard to replace, because they just used those guys to replace previous guys last year. So in terms of filling, you know, that quarterback coach position is probably the most critical spot to fill. You know, that quarterback coach is often the bridge between the offensive coordinator and the quarterback. Dan Quinn, rightly, you know, a lot of people on Falcons Twitter disagree with this take today, at least. But I think Dan Quinn rightly said that Matt Ryan would not have any input on the quarterback coach. I don't believe in living in a world where players have input in who the coaches are, but it is what it is. So there's three main candidates that we've been publicly known. Today we found out a third one in Ken Dorsey. Prior to that, we had heard about Jed Fish. We had heard about Greg Knapp. Dorsey's interesting because, as far as I know, he has no experience running or playing in a West Coast offense. So that will be an interesting thing. Now, for those of you that don't know, Dorsey has spent the last four, I think, years being Cam Newton's quarterback coach in Carolina. He was recently dismissed when they sort of turned over their offensive coaching staff. If they wound up going with Dorsey, that would be a relatively weird hire, in my opinion, just because he does not have that West Coast background. Fish and Knapp certainly do have that West Coast background. Fish was the offensive coordinator under Gus Bradley in Jacksonville. And, of course, Greg Knapp has basically been Jim Moore's go-to offensive coordinator anytime he's been a head coach in the NFL, including in Atlanta, and most recently in 2009 in Seattle, when Dan Quinn was also the defensive line coach. Fish's connection to Dan Quinn is that he was on the Seahawks staff. He was hired by Pete Carroll in 2010, the following year, as the Seahawks quarterback coach. And, you know, Dan Quinn was retained as the defensive line coach. For those of you that don't know, Fish was the offensive coordinator for UCLA this past year, wound up when Jim Moore got fired. He wound up taking over as the interim head coach. And, you know, he also coached Josh Rosen, who's potentially the number one pick in the draft, who I think is a very much Matt Ryan type of clone type of guy. You know, Knapp was a guy that I thought the Falcons would try to lure away last year when he was not retained by Vance Joseph's staff in Denver. He had spent the four previous years as a quarterback coach in Denver. You know, if you can get past your old beefs with Greg Knapp, then, you know, I think him or Fish makes a lot more sense. Knapp certainly outweighs those guys in terms of NFL experience. And so if one of your criticisms or one of your concerns about Sarkisian moving forward is that lack of NFL experience, remember, he only spent 1 year as an NFL assistant way back in 2004 under Norv Turner, who took over for Carolina. It's all interconnected. But, you know, I think, you know, if that's sort of what your concern is, then it does make sense that Knapp would be probably your preferred choice. Again, if you can get over your hurdles, those hurdles and your hangups from when Knapp was the offensive coordinator in Atlanta when Vic was the quarterback. You know, I don't necessarily have a horse in the race. If the Falcons did wind up choosing Dorsey, it would be weird to me just because I don't think he has a West Coast background, and it would be weird to pick a coach. You know, that would leave a lot, that would raise a lot of questions like, oh, are we going away from the West Coast offense? Or, you know, like, I don't know. But we'll see how it goes. You know, there's also been speculation that Chris Richard, the former Seahawks defensive coordinator, is also on the Falcons radar. Whether the Falcons sign him to be some sort of defensive passing coordinator, assistant head coach, DB's coach, who knows? They just, you know, when they were promoted Marquand Manuel, the former DB coach, to DC, they moved the assistant linebacker coach, Doug Mallory, to DB coach. And so, you know, maybe they would move Mallory around to make way for Richard. You know, I'm not one of these people that cares too much about assistant coaches. You know, I don't have takes on, you know, like, oh, we should fire Brian Cox because he's bad, or this guy, if we hire this guy, all of a sudden these, you know, like, I know Wade Harmon's a good assistant coach. Outside of that, I don't really have any takes on the Falcons assistant coaches too much. So whatever, like if they hire one of these guys, it would be whatever. If they don't, it's whatever, you know. You know, I joked with somebody on Twitter the other day that, you know, I don't really care about assistant coaches and whatnot. You know, my wheelhouse is fourth string running backs and debating the intricacies of, you know, who should, you know, that type of stuff. So, you know, the other news that we found out, that Devontae Freeman won't have surgery on his knee. He suffered a PCL/MCL strain in week 17. So that's positive. Sounds like, you know, that's an issue that, you know, 4 to 6 to 8 weeks from now, he can be fully healed and recovered and ready for OTAs and whatnot. So that's a positive. So we don't have to worry about that becoming an issue this offseason. And being concerned about our running back depth, because our running back, you know, goes into June and in July, not less than 100%. As far as the news goes, I think that's pretty much covers it. I mean, I could sit here and go deep on the nine guys we signed the futures contracts, but it's basically the same guys in the practice squad. And if you've been listening to the podcast since August, you know what my takes on several of those guys are. It was interesting, I guess, that the Falcons did not retain Josh Perkins. I know he was injured during the season and so wasn't technically on the practice squad. He got scooped up by the Eagles, I think. So, you know, tough loss because we all thought Perkins had some talent. As a receiver, you know, I don't have much else to add to that. You know, I think the Falcons, you know, hopefully Saubert winds up developing and showing some growth, and so we won't feel like we lost a solid player, a solid depth piece in Josh Perkins moving forward. So, all right, guys, I want to hit the pause button on this episode of Locked On Falcons to plug Locked On Vikings. As host Sam Ekstrom, friend of the show, and former NFL quarterback Sage Rosenfels discussed on the recent episode of their reaction to the Vikings' remarkable win over the Saints last weekend. I think you guys, my listeners, will get a kick out of this because not only does it come at the Saints' expense, but I think the Vikings, similar to the Falcons, are sort of a long-suffering franchise. And I think, you know, even though the Falcons' season is over, football is still going on. And I think this Vikings team is one that I know myself, and, you know, I'd like to believe that some of you listeners out there as well that are Falcon fans can get behind this weekend in the NFC Championship game as they go against the Philadelphia Eagles. So I want to play that audio for you guys. And if you guys want to head on over to Locked On Vikings, find it wherever podcasts can be found, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Sage, there was a lot of protocol being broken yesterday in the press box, a box that is usually full of stoic, curmudgeonly men. And when the play happened, it was like everybody's impartiality went out the window. Everybody put their fan hat on for that moment. Everybody stood. Everybody reacted. There was hugging. There was crying in the press box. It was unbelievable. I made eye contact with you at the moment. I don't know if you saw me, but your head was going through the ceiling. It was amazing.
I was, it was like a mix of shock and celebration. I mean, I think even the writers who were there, and I was standing next to Peter King, and it's like you're in shock. Like, did that just happen? And then the game's actually over? And I felt like even the impartial writers who are just covering the game, they were celebrating because they knew they had just seen really a once-in-a-lifetime game and a once-in-a-lifetime play. It was absolutely unbelievable. One of the most amazing game that I've ever witnessed. I was at that Bounty Gate game, you know, and 8 years ago. And there's so much going into the game for me personally with the Saints and thinking about the sort of the rematch with the Vikings. Now we had them at home. And then, you know, for the Vikings to get the 17-0 lead and then in sort of classic Vikings fashion, give up that lead and you think the game's over, and then to win it with this miracle throw and catch from Case to Stephon Diggs, the missed tackle, the run for the end zone, the walk-off touchdown for a Vikings victory in the playoffs. Absolutely unbelievable.
And this is why it's the best play in Vikings history, because what have Minnesota fans grown accustomed to? They've grown accustomed to having their hopes at the highest possible level, like whether it's 98, Gary Anderson missing the kick, whether it's 2009, Favre throwing across his body, whether it's Blair Walsh attempting a chip shot field goal, everybody experienced the high and then the devastation, whereas this game was the exact opposite. The emotional script got flipped with the high followed by just a low of lows, a 17-point blown lead, which the Vikings haven't done, I think. They haven't blown a double-digit lead since 2014. They gave up the most points they had at home all year. You give up a 4th-and-10 to Drew Brees, who was cold-blooded in the final quarter and a half, just Hall of Fame caliber. So to have that low and to get be prepared for like a snowy drive home in the frigid weather just to mourn, then that happens. It's the perfect catharsis for years of Vikings heartbreak, and to do it against the Saints no less, and then to happen with no time on the clock, players streaming on the field and just the awe on their faces. They were all little children out there. That was so cool to see all the reactions.
It felt like there was redemption against the Saints, but it really felt like there was redemption against the history of the Vikings franchise. It was like all those bad things that happened in the past for decades somehow came back, and on one special play, everything went right. And nobody was surprised in that football game that Drew Brees came back. I mean, the guy, just incredible. By the way, happy birthday to Drew Brees. I mean, what a crappy birthday today. He turns 39. The guy played like the Hall of Famer that he is. I mean, he might be able to play for another 8 or 10 years. Absolutely incredible performance by him in his offense. He battled and battled and found completions and found first downs and found touchdowns and took advantage of every Vikings miscue, brought his team back, took the lead. Case comes back down, takes the lead. To no one's surprise, with a minute and a half left, Breeze goes right down and scores a touchdown or kicks the field goal to take the lead. And then obviously with 25 seconds left, the Vikings had a couple plays to try to get really, I don't even think in field goal range. I think really they were just trying to get in Hail Mary range. I mean, you're sort of screwed at that point. I mean, how are we going to get the ball down to the 40-yard line of the other team? You know, there's not enough time to throw a pass in the middle of the field to come up and spike the ball. We're going to have to throw the ball to the sidelines. You know they're going to take away all the deep throws, so we'll probably have to throw it in the flat to Kyle Rudolph for a 7-yard gain, maybe for an 8-yard gain. Maybe we can get the ball out to midfield and have one last chance at a Hail Mary. But that's not what happened. Case pushed the ball down the field. They let Diggs get open, but he should have been tackled, obviously, but he wasn't. And as I said, everything that had gone wrong, it seemed like, in that football game for the Vikings, all of a sudden flipped and went right. Absolutely unbelievable.
Now, I hope you guys enjoyed that. But let's get back to the Falcons. I know that's why you guys came here. That's why you subscribed. You know, maybe we'll talk with the Vikings later on this season if they happen to move forward, but we'll see. Let's get back to what, you know, sort of the deep dive of today's episode, which is going to be hitting up those, discussing in depth those three things that Dan Quinn listed in the press conferences as what he diagnosed as the crux of the problems of why the Falcons offense wasn't as effective this current season as it was a year ago in 2016 when they were one of the record-setting offenses of all time. He pointed out the red zone struggles, turnover margin, and the lack of explosive play touchdowns. And I think, you know, looking at the numbers, I think you can pretty much say, yeah, he's pretty spot on. And the way that you can sort of think about it is each one of those instances represent a certain amount of points lost that the Falcons had a year ago that they did not have last year. Now, I'll first bring up the big plays just because you guys know how close I am to that. But you look at the big plays, and the research I've done over the years is basically, and again, my research has been focused solely on the Falcons, and one of the projects I plan on working on this offseason is sort of expanding that to a league-wide whole. But one of the things I've noticed over many, many years of studying the amount of big 20-plus plays that the Falcons had in previous years and how highly that correlates, you know, on drives that include a 20-plus yard play, the chances of you scoring go up like 3 or 4 times, sometimes even more. The number of points that you generate per drive go up significantly. The chance of you getting into the red zone go up, all that type of stuff. I've talked about this a lot on this podcast over the last couple of years, so you guys should be relatively familiar with what I'm talking about. But basically what I'm trying to get at is what I've discovered is in any given year over the last 5 or 6 years, for every big play, if you look at the amount of points that the Falcons score on a drive that includes a big play, and then look at the number of big plays that the team generates over the course of a season, which are mostly tied to those drives, typically over the last 4 or 5 years, it varies from season to season, but the number of points you generate per big play amount ranges somewhere between like 3.7, 5 points, and 5 points. And so for the sake of argument, we'll just round it to a nice even number of 4 points per big play. So every 20-plus yard play, you can think of in a way as basically being worth 4 points of offense. And so you look at last season's number of big plays that the Falcons had. They had 84 big plays. And this year they had 66, if I'm not mistaken. So that's 18 less big plays, and that equals about 72 points lost from last year to this year just in lack of big plays. You know, that's about, you know, what, 4.5, I'm sorry, I can't do math, 4.5 points per game lost just off of big plays. Then you look at the turnovers. And last year, the Falcons turned the ball over 11 times. This year, they turned the ball over 18 times. So that's seven additional turnovers. Now, you know, probably not coincidentally, the Falcons had seven picks this year off of deflections. So, you know, the drop passes and the deflections were, you know, arguably the you know, a big part of why the Falcons turned the ball over much more. Now, the interesting thing about the turnover thing is, and again, this is more of another shot in the dark, really, but one of the things I discovered several years ago, and I don't remember the exact number, but, you know, several years ago, I found that the average NFL team scores about 3.3 or 3.5, somewhere in that range, points per turnover that they generate. So, you know, when you force a turnover on another team, generally speaking, you're going to get about, on average, 3.5 points for each time you do that. So basically, like, if in a game, typically, you know, the way that you can think about it is, like, if you're in a football game and you force two turnovers in that game, it's very likely that one of those drives will lead to a touchdown. And so 7 divided by 2 is 3.5. That's sort of the way that you can sort of think about it. Or you just consistently get field goals every time you force these short field. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to make a little bit of a logical leap, but say, okay, if the defense is able to produce 3.5 points every time they force a turnover, maybe that means that the offense is losing 3.5 points every time they commit a turnover. Now, you know, that doesn't necessarily hold the strongest logic, but it does have some sort of, you know, it's, again, I haven't done enough research to suggest whether that's true or not, because it's hard to glean sort of how many points are lost on turnovers, because, you know, how many points are lost on not converting a third down, you know, so it's hard to do that research. But let's, for the sake of argument, assume that every time a team turns the ball over, you know, in the same way that if you turn the ball over twice, probably one of those drives you would have scored a touchdown or something like that. So 3.5 points. So with seven more turnovers, if you 3.5 points per turnover, that's almost about 25 points loss. So again, that's about 1.5 points per game. So, you know, just off of the big plays and the turnovers, the Falcons are losing about 6 points per game, almost a touchdown. Now, then you get into the red zone. And the red zone is where I think we can go a little bit deeper, because we haven't talked as much about it. And the Falcons only converted about 50% of their red zone trips this year, which I think was like 23rd in the league. Last year, they converted 62%, right? And so what you have, and one of the things that happened, you know, again, I would blame partially on the lack of explosiveness, but the Falcons didn't have as many red zone trips this year as they did last year. They had 63 last year and 54 this year. So they lost 9 red zone trips. Now, if you assume that they would convert a little more than half of them, of those 9, that's about 5 touchdowns lost just on not having as many red zone opportunities, scoring opportunities, as they did a year ago. So that's 5 touchdowns that the Falcons lost. Then you throw on top of that, on the 54 red zone trips that they did have this year, if they had converted 62 of those, they would have had 33 successful conversions as opposed to the 27 that they wound up with this year. So again, that's another 6 touchdowns lost just by not being able to convert as many. And so you do the math on that. Again, that's 11 less touchdowns based purely off the red zone struggles this year as opposed to last year. So 11 touchdowns, that's 77 points. So 77 plus 72 plus 25 amounts to 174 points. So then you look at the amount of points that the Falcons offense fell back from last year. They fell back 187 points, if I'm not mistaken. So again, you're 174, basically like 2 different touchdowns. So basically those 3 things basically account for 174 out of the 187 points that the Falcons lost. So, you know, I think Dan Quinn is on to something when he points to those 3 things being, you know, the main reasons why the Falcons offense took a major step back this year. And again, you know, it's one of the reasons why I don't quite buy the whole execution thing to the same level that other people have. I do think it's fair to say that certain, you know, there were big plays that were left on the field due to drops. I certainly think there were big plays left on the field due to the quarterback not making accurate throws as well. And I think that was a major issue for the first half of the season, more so than the drop passes. Maybe the drops became a little bit more problematic in the second half of the season when Matt Ryan's deep ball accuracy picked up quite a bit. But, you know, I think, you know, I think, and this is where I'm going to get into the Sark aspect of it. I think a lot of these issues, particularly the red zone, you know, the turnovers, again, the deflections. Yeah. Okay. That's fair. You know, we lost 23 points. You can make a case that 25 points were lost off of drop deflected passes that turned into interceptions or something like that. But, you know, I think the red zone stuff is more about the offensive coordinator. I think the big play stuff is more about the offensive coordinator than it necessarily is the drop passes. But one of the things I do plan on doing this weekend, but before we get into the positional previews, is trying to finish charting up the season so I can actually give a real number on sort of how many big plays the Falcons lost this year due to drop passes. So, you know, hopefully next week I will have that information for you. But like looking at the red zone, one of the things I talked about on Sunday's Rapid Reaction podcast was the drop in production that Julio Jones had in the red zone this year, where Matt Ryan's passer rating on targets to Julio Jones this year was 56.3, which was 101.6 last year. And you look at, not only was it Julio Jones that had a significant decline in his red zone production in terms of Matt Ryan's passer rating this year, but you also saw a significant dip in Mohamed Sanu, where his passer rating from last year was 115.7 and it was 67.3 this year. Taylor Gabriel was 135.4 last year, and now in this year it was 39.6. You saw some sustained success from guys like Justin Hardy, from guys like Austin Hooper, Tevin Coleman, Devontae Freeman as well. Their numbers are comparable, and in some cases they improved this past year. But the one stat that really sort of stood out to me was more so than these things, because I think, you know, before I get there, I do want to wrap that up, that put a button on this, by saying, like, I think a lot of that has to do with not being able to create as many opportunities for some of these guys and really understanding how to use these guys. And one of the criticisms I've given at Sark quite a bit this year is I think the route combinations haven't been great. And I think, you know, if you go check out the YouTube video by Brett Coleman, who basically broke down, I posted a tweeted it out today, and I'm sure if you were on Falcons Twitter at any point Thursday, you probably saw a link to it. And so some of the criticism he had for Sark's game plan in his game, and it was like he pointed out some of the plays that I noticed on film that was like, yeah, that was a kind of a dull route combination. But for me, it was one of those things where it's like, I didn't even really have that strong a reaction to it because it's something I've seen throughout this season. And it's just like, yeah, they have kind of vanilla route combinations and it doesn't really effectively utilize guys to get open. It's one of the things that Brett mentioned on his video, which was sort of like not using the rub routes and sort of just running basic slants, and that played into the arm, into the hands of the Eagles secondary, which I mentioned on the All 22 review, which they were able to man up our guys, and because we don't really throw certain route combinations that are designed to sort of attack man coverage and attack certain coverages, it leads to the struggles you have on offense. But so I think that's a more big picture issue. But getting back to the red zone specifically, one of the stats that really jumped out to me was the percentage of target red zone targets that Matt Ryan attempted this year that went to Julio Jones. And this goes back to a point I made with the Locked On Eagles guys. And it was shocking to me to actually look at the numbers again after that podcast 2 weeks ago or a week ago when we talked about Julio's lack of success or lack of targets in the red zone. And it was shocking once I went back and looked at it to see some of the eye-popping numbers with how, you know, the passer rating was down. But the thing that stood out to me is this past season, 28.2% of Matt Ryan's red zone targets went to Julio Jones. Last year, that number was 11.7%. And Matt Ryan's passer rating in the red zone was 30 points higher in 2016 than it was this year. And interesting enough, if you go back to 2015, another year where the Falcons were not exactly a great red zone team, they were more successful in the red zone then, converting 54.7% and finishing 17th in the league in 2015, but still not necessarily a good red zone team. 28.8% of their red zone targets went to Julio Jones. And so it's one of those things where it's like when the Falcons force feed the ball to Julio Jones in the red zone, it doesn't lead to, at least the last 3 years tell us, it does not lead to significant amount of success. And in fact, it actually hurts their red zone offense. And I think that's part of the issue where, you know, and again, like in the postseason, I'm all for Julio Jones being force fed the ball because you need him because you're not necessarily winning a whole bunch of matchups against these top tier defenses, particularly when you have offensive line issues. But in terms of the regular season, that's been a problem when you force feed Julio Jones the ball. And particularly in the red zone, I'm not that big a fan of it. And one of the things that was interesting about the 2016 team is Sanu and Freeman led the team in red zone targets. Coleman and Jones both had 13. They were tied for third. Tammy had 11. Hardy had 10. You know, Hooper had 7. Gabriel had 6 in 2016. So in reality, Justin Hardy was just as much an asset in the red zone with almost the same number of targets, almost the same number of catches, and the same number of touchdowns that Julio Jones had in 2016. And that's because, you know, of quote-unquote play calling and Kyle Shanahan spreading the ball around and making teams pay for spending all that time, you know, with their attention focused on Julio Jones and being able to open up opportunities for other guys. And that was not something that Sark was able to do. Julio had almost twice as many red zone targets this year as the next best guy, which was Sanu, who had, you know, Julio had 24 this year and Sanu had 13. Even though Julio only had 2 red zone touchdowns and Sanu had 5. So, you know, Sanu was converting, you know, red zone touchdowns, you know, at a rate of like, you know, almost 5 times as much as Julio was. So it's one of those things, and like you could certainly say that all the attention that Julio got created opportunities for Sanu, but besides Sanu, that really didn't trickle down to anybody else other than maybe Justin Hardy, who had 3 red zone touchdowns on 7 targets. And so one of the things, you know, you go back to that 2015 season, you know, I'm rambling a little bit, but you go back to that 2015 season and some of the red zone issues, I think you could blame on the lack of personnel. You know, one of the things that we talked about then was, you know, coming out of that 2015 season was needing to upgrade the tight end position and getting more of a quote-unquote power forward type at that position. Because when you look at a guy, Jacob Tammy, who's more of an H-back in all reality, he's not really a guy that really did well in the red zone that year. A number of Matt Ryan's interceptions were Jacob Tammy targets, and he just did not do a great job converting on those situations because he's not a power forward. He's not a big body. And so going out and getting a guy like Hooper made a lot of sense in that regard. But then you go back to a lot of the other issues the team dealt with in 2015, which was, you know, Tammy wasn't a power forward. Hankerson missed half the season. Hardy missed half the season. Roddy was a shell of himself. And Nick Williams, for much of the season, was the fourth receiver. And he's like 5'7", 5'7 and a half. You know, so that's not going to be a valuable asset in the red zone. So it made total sense that the Falcons would sort of regroup, pick up a guy like Hooper, a 6'5 tight end that, you know, I know a lot of people criticize his ball skills this year. But if you go back and you watch his highlight reel at Stanford, or, you know, if you watch tape, if you had the time, but go ahead and watch the highlight reel, all you're going to see is him making, you know, leaping grabs in traffic. So it's not that he lacks ball skills at all. It's just people are like looking at like 3 plays and say, oh, he didn't show great ball skills on these plays. And so therefore he lacks ball skills. No, it's just, he's got to get better. You got Sanu, who's what, 6'2", 6'3". You got Justin Hardy, who's not necessarily the biggest big body receiver, but is a lot better in traffic than I think a lot of people realize, and it's been reflected in relatively consistent red zone production the last 2 years. And so he's no longer this green guy that he was in 2015, and certainly it's a much better option there than Nick Williams was. So I think a lot of the issues, even though we make constant comparisons between the 2015 season and 2017 season, a lot of the issues are not personnel related like they were back then. And so, like, yeah, I look at a lot of the issues on the Falcons' offense. You know, I think the fullback position, yeah, that's personnel-related. You could argue that the interior line play, that's personnel-related, even though, I think the interior line got a lot more flack than it necessarily deserved this year. You can look at, you know, the inconsistencies of the tight end position as personnel related, not in relation to Hooper, but in relation to Toi Lolo. But I do think Toi Lolo played much better in the second half of the season. So I'm not as sort of adamant on we need to replace Toi Lolo. You know, I'd love to replace him. But even then, Toi Lolo's, I've always thought Toi Lolo was an underrated red zone, an underrated and underutilized red zone option for the Falcons. So, you know, that's something the Falcons have to deal with or try to fix. But I look at it, and so just to me, it's like, I don't think, you know, the long story short is the point I'm trying to make is, even though the Falcons, you know, I think the bulk of these three issues that Dan Quinn pointed out, I think a lot of it has to do with the play calling. Some of it has to do with the execution, and those things will improve. But if this team is going to get back to a level where they have a legitimately potent offense that can actually scare some of these top defenses. Again, we go back and we look at this 2017 season. We played Minnesota. We played Miami. We played Buffalo. We played Carolina. We played New Orleans. We played the Rams. We played the Eagles. And how many of those teams did we really scare? You know, like we beat up on an injury-plagued Seahawks defense. But, like, most of those defenses had no problem shutting down our offense this year, because we don't really do anything creatively to really attack their defenses in any major way. And so, you know, I think the main issue, whether you like it or not, Sark's going to stick around. You know, it's whatever to me. You know, again, as I said earlier, I don't spend too much time worrying about assistant coaches, but, like, he's definitely going to have to improve. And again, I remain skeptical that he will improve. But, you know, I'll be hopeful, and hopefully we'll see what happens. You know, again, I don't think the Falcons need to go out and be like, oh, we got to upgrade our personnel. We got to get new wide receivers because these guys drop too many passes. We need to get a new tight end because this guy, like, it's not that issue. That is not the issue. Trust me. That is not the issue with the Atlanta Falcons. It is not because they do not have enough talented players at wide receiver, at running back, at tight end, or on the offensive line. That is not their issue. Their issue is related, not entirely, but mostly, to their play calling and the sort of lack of creativity in their offense. And so, you know, that's going to be something that Sark's going to have to get better at. I think if he does, then these three areas that we discussed, the explosiveness, the red zone, and the turnovers, will go down. Right. Some of those issues, again, are related to execution. But again, you can reasonably expect some of those. Like, you're not going to expect 7 of Matt Ryan's passes to be deflected. But again, that only accounts for 25 points or so. So that's not going to make a significant, you know, you're only adding a field goal every other game, basically, if you limit the turnovers. So it's really going to be focused on the red zone, being much more efficient in the red zone, which I think he can be if he's smarter with his play calling, and it's going to be much better with this team finding ways to be explosive. And again, I think a lot of the issues that Matt Ryan had with his deep ball being crappy for the first half of the season probably has a lot to do with not having comfort running the system, the lack of timing in this offense, and hopefully you hope that those things will improve next season. But again, I do think Sark needs to find better ways to find opportunities to exploit teams for big plays. And again, this was something I talked about on the podcast. Down the stretch, the Falcons' big plays largely came from short, quick passes to the wide receivers and those guys making guys miss in the after the catch. And, you know, we need to see more designed splash plays, more designed shot plays. And, you know, obviously when the Falcons do design those opportunities, they need to take full advantage of that. Quarterback has to throw better deep balls. Receivers have to not drop those passes, etc. But we just did not see an explosive offense. And as you guys may remember, what was the first rapid reaction I did this year? When we talked about the Bears game, and I went on a rant where it's like, we're not going back to those pre-Shanahan offenses where we weren't explosive. We've been there and done that. And the big complaint about this year's offense is this offense was very much like those pre-Shanahan offenses with the lack of explosive. Now, to Stark's credit, they were as explosive, roughly as explosive this year as they were in 2014, which I believe was either the number one or number two, either behind 2008 or number one, in terms of the most explosive years we had in the Matt Ryan era prior to Shanahan's arrival. But That being said, like, we got to get better because this offense is not going to be able to go. And it, again, this was my criticism that I said on a previous episode of the podcast, which is, unless this team can find ways to be better on offense, I don't think this team's ceiling offensively is Super Bowl. And that was, to me, the big issue with the Cutter and Malarkey offenses. While they were good at being consistent on a week-to-week basis during the regular season, they didn't have what it takes to take their offense to a new level in the postseason, you know, outside of the 2012 year when it was basically, Julio Jones lighting the world on fire. And so basically that was my one hope for this postseason, which was, you know, Julio Jones lighting the world on fire, because I don't have any confidence that the offense is going to be able to get more out of itself than it did throughout the regular season. So that's going to be something that's going to have to change with Sark. If he changes that, then I think, you know, I won't say the sky is the limit, but, you know, certainly there's a much higher ceiling on how far this team can make it in the postseason. Should that happen. Otherwise, they're just going to have to rely on basically hoping that they build up a defense as good as the Vikings or the Eagles defense. And so that's one of the reasons why, and again, we'll get into this later, but one of the reasons why I do think the Falcons should not neglect their defensive personnel. In fact, I think they should focus still on their defensive personnel, because again, the Falcons' issues on offense are not personnel related, but we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. That's it, guys. I appreciate you guys tuning in. Wrapping up this week, again, as I said on the previous episode, next week we will get to some postseason year-end wrap-ups. We're going to go position by position. We're going to talk quarterbacks and running backs and fullbacks. You know my favorite position on Monday. I'll devote 5 minutes to the quarterback, 5 minutes to the running backs, and 25 minutes to the fullback position on Monday's episode. But look forward to that. We'll do wide receivers and tight ends on Tuesday. And then send in those questions. Send in any suggestions that you have for the offseason. I'm all ears. This is the opportunity, as I said on a previous episode, that you guys can really sort of get into the mix. Again, I'll remind you that we will be doing our awards sometime, probably February 1st, February 2nd, or something like that. So if you have any suggested categories for the awards, then by all means, send those in. And of course, you can do so by tweeting at me. I'm at FalFans on Twitter. If you want to let me know it's podcast related, just let me know in that tweet. Otherwise, just go ahead and send it to Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle. If you hate Twitter character limits, there is Facebook. The Locked On Falcons page is the Facebook page. You can also email at lockedonfalcons@mail.com. You also have, you can leave comments on lockedonfalcons.com and falcfans.com. Check out, I'll be doing a leftover mailbag on lockedonfalcons.com. I don't know if I have too many Eagles game related questions, so we might get into the off-season's talk a little bit on that leftover mailbag this weekend. So definitely check that out on lockedonfalcons.com. That should go up either probably on Saturday or so. So look forward to that. And yeah, we'll keep this thing going, guys. And I appreciate you guys for, you know, undergoing, you know, persevering through the changes that we went through last offseason with Alan leaving the show. And, you know, you guys staying loyal and continuing to show your faith in me this season. And I hope you guys continue to do so this offseason. I know it hasn't been maybe, I know for some of you it wasn't necessarily an easy choice to do so, because you guys were big fans of Alan and remain big fans of Alan, as you should be. I'm a big fan of Alan. It was tough to see how that, you know, for that to end the way it did, but I'm going to keep striving to do what I do and provide you guys with great content on this podcast moving forward. You know, there is no replacing Alan Sterk. And so, as I said last offseason, I don't intend to add a co-host, but I certainly do want to, you know, not bore you guys with me talking ad nauseum to myself. And so we'll continue to try to get some great guests this offseason and hopefully build the brand, expand our horizons, and talk a lot of interesting football stuff. You know, one of the goals I hope to do is not necessarily keep everything Falcons focused, and let's have good football related content that may deal with other teams and talk bigger, you know, bigger league wide issues than necessarily just being hyper focused on the Falcons. But that's something certainly that we can look forward to a little bit later in the offseason as things move forward. So again, as always, I tend to ramble on at the end of this episode, but I appreciate you guys. And thank you for a great 2017. And I look forward to an even better 2018.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, late breaking news. Darryl Bevell's also in the mix for the vacancy for the Falcons quarterback coach. He's the former Seattle Seahawks offensive coordinator, been there since, I think, 2011. So he has a shared history with Dan Quinn. This news sort of broke while I was recording the podcast initially. I didn't find out about it until afterwards. So just wanted to cover all my bases. If he does wind up being the Falcons selection for the quarterback coach, then we'll at some point, probably next week or whenever that move is official, we'll go a little bit more in depth and really sort of examine his record in Seattle.